This is The Good Die Young, the podcast where we deep dive into the greatest television you barely saw. I'm your host, Les Weiler. Join me as I take you through what made these shows too pretty to live. This is The Good Die Young. Season 1, The Middleman. Hey, Nick, it's Les.
Hey.
How's it going?
Going really well.
Cool.
Well, I should preface that as it's going well, as in I have been watching some good TV lately. As far as, like, you know, general state of things, it's, I don't know, it could, I'd say it could be worse, but I don't know how.
No, and yeah, I really don't want to spend any time thinking about how it could be worse. Like, I feel like that's like purposely thinking of a marshmallow man at the end of Ghostbusters. Like,
yes. Oh, choose the form of your destroyer. What? All right, fine. Clear your minds. Clear your mind. Oh, God damn it. Who thought of this orange son of a bitch? Ah, Ray.
It's Ray's fault.
Fucking Ray.
All right. So welcome to The Good Die Young, The Middleman, where we're going through episode by episode through shows that died too young, too pretty to live. Just couldn't stick around. So this time we're going through The Middleman, going through episode 7, The Cursed Tuba Contingency.
Or Highlander with a Tuba. Hashtag Highlander with a Tuba.
And I am joined today with a co-host from the UGO podcast. Nick, tell me how to pronounce your name.
It's Nick Tice, because the H is actually silent, because my ancestors were not only German, but they were also asshats, apparently.
Ass-ats.
Ass-ats, yes. I mean, you know that was some, it was pronounced thighs at one point, but then some douche of my ancestors was like, actually it's pronounced thighs, you know, like out of nowhere, and just ruined.
Frankenstein.
Frankenstein, yes. But yes, I do host a podcast. It's pretty fun. The Unapologetic Geek Out podcast on iTunes, where I also do interviews with some other content creators, and some good jazz like that. We talk about, you know, movies, TV, and, you know, stuff that's on our pop culture kind of radar, and it's a good time. So if you got time after watching episodes of Middlemen over and over again, I understand it's necessary for your health. But in between then, if you want to check us out on iTunes, you can totally do that.
Yeah, and I was lucky enough to be interviewed by you guys right after ATX Fest earlier this year. And I think that's where we talked about Middleman briefly, because I tend to bring the show up a lot. And was that the first time that you'd heard about it?
Okay, yes. So here is the origin story of my love for Middleman, which is less based. So we recorded for our episode 86 of the UGO podcast, titled More or Less Weiler. And the inciting, so we were talking about, I think, time travel TV. I think we were talking about Arrowverse stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And somehow we got onto the subject of Middleman. I'm like, what the hell is Middleman? I have no idea what Middleman is. And I think you even shot me a link later in the day,
yes,
which was like, here's the link to like the first episode of Middleman.
Yeah, I tend to proselytize that show. Like, I would go door to door on Saturday mornings and hand out tracks. Like,
you messaged me like a week after that too, after like when our episode went up for yours, and I shot you that link, and you're like, oh yeah, did you by the way watch any of Middleman? And I think I messaged you back. I think my exact words where I've only watched episode 1, and I only have one question. Where can I find the rest of this show? Because this is amazing.
Yeah, I smiled huge when I read that, because it's always great to recommend a show, but it's really great to get the response back of like, how have I not heard of this? What crime happened that I did not know this show existed?
Okay, yeah, and I know this is episode 7, so we're probably going to be repeat, like everyone's going to be already listening to listen to how many people say this exact thing, but This show was 2004 on ABC.
2007 and 8, yeah.
2007, was it? Oh, okay. I'm mixed up on my dates. And if I were to describe this show, it would be like, okay, what would Nick like when he was a teenager, condensed down, like, the best parts of the pop culture references of Buffy the Vampire Slayer mixed with Super... It's like if Joss Whedon actually wrote Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Like, and I'm like, oh, it's too bad that I didn't find this in my youth, because teenage Nick would love this. But then I remember, no, this was 2007. I was a teenager when this is out, but just for some reason, someone was responsible for not letting me know this show existed. And whoever is responsible for that deserves a slow, painful death, my friend. they are on my lipstick list.
This fell. That's great. This fell into one of those weird spots in time right before the advent of like Twitter and a couple of second screen ways that you could have shared this. But there just wasn't an oh my god, did you hear about this, Game of Thrones is going to spread like wildfire. That really wasn't there in 2007, 2008. So the only people I knew about that actively saw this show were three or four people who I know were torrenting everything. And so it literally was just a what's that, it's in the list of just shows that they had grabbed off something. So they knew about it, but nobody knew where it would have aired. Or, I mean, if it hadn't had an ABC Family logo in the bottom corner of it, I would have had no idea what channel did that. It was just weird. Like, the nerd audience that would have loved it wasn't at ABC Family. And really, with 700 Club and everything, there was no ABC Family audience yet. And there really wasn't a good way to, like, grab your geek friends and go, no, I swear, just turn to this channel, please.
This show was just a couple years too late for a Twitter campaign to save it.
Yeah.
Like, it's undeniably frustrating when I end up wrap up watching it. I was like, god damn it. Another Firefly gone with the wind.
Yes. And similar to Firefly, there's an argument online or with Amazon on what order the episodes go in. IMDb has them out of order, and so does Amazon. They switch, I think, episode 4 and episode 2.
Yes, and that I noticed that when I was watching it, because there's a reference to Succubus in an earlier episode before the, because we'll be talking about, yeah, Succubus in this episode, but there's a reference to it before they even show up, and I'm like, whoa, is Wendy like psychic, or are her paintings coming true? Like, I was so I thought it was part of the show until later I realized it was just out of order.
If there's only one season, and then that means that your character is learning the ropes. So if you flip them out of order, that character bonding is messed up. They did the same thing with Don't Tell the Bee, or Don't Trust the Bee. That show is hopelessly out of order if you try to watch it online.
For Amazon especially, I have a problem with how they list stuff and how they order. Like, I'm a big Steven Universe fan, and their episode, their how they track and episodes and seasons of Steven Universe is fucking atrocious.
God, there's a ton of episodes of that too. I mean,
yeah, and it's just like Amazon. Come on, you want to get into this? You know, competing with Netflix and Hulu and HBO Now game. You got to step up your game on this. Make it a little easier for me to watch the goddamn show.
Yeah, the only thing Netflix is doing wrong for me right now is occasionally it judges me with this passive aggressive. Are you still watching that? Shut up, Netflix. you don't know me. I'm still watching it.
Yes, I'm still alive. Yeah. Thank you.
Like, it's your show. Why'd you put 12 hours up all at once? You didn't want me to watch it all. All right. So episode 7, The Cursed Tuba Contingency. It's directed by Jeremiah Chechik and written by Hans Beimler. This is the only episode that's written by Beimler, but Chechik directed a huge number of these. He also directed the movie Benny and June, if you ever saw that with Johnny Depp, which is a great movie. Depp is this Buster Keaton obsessed kid, so it's got a lot of Buster Keaton gags and really fun movie, but just odd connection that Chechik. I didn't know him as a movie director particularly. I kind of knew him because he's all over the credits for Middleman, and so it was kind of neat to realize, like, oh wait, you directed a movie I really love. Wow. And so the basic plot of this episode is as you put it, it's Highlander with a tuba. You almost have like a picture of Dorian Gray with a beat up tuba kind of thing. you have Joey Kern, who is an actor that I kind of wish would blow up bigger. I liken him to like the Skeet Ulrich. Like he is Matthew McConaughey's Skeet Ulrich to Johnny Depp. Like, he feels like the poor man's McConaughey to me.
Oh my God. God, like, okay, so I was trying to figure out who this actor reminded me of, and you fucking nailed it with fucking poor man's Matthew McConaughey.
He's in a movie called Grind, and he is straight up Wooderson. Like, he is just McConaughey from Dazed and Confused. But it's kind of like watching Tyler Labine's early stuff where you go, oh man, this could be a bad one-note joke. Like, you were written a bad one-note joke, and you're doing a little more with it than you needed to. And I feel that way about Joey Kern most of the time I've seen him. So when he popped up in this episode, I was like, awesome. And true to form, he is the smarmiest immortal. I love him.
Oh, he's such a dick.
So, so the episode starts out. Wendy wakes up. Lacey's pissed off that she's ruined her boots, and they're just covered in green gunk. Like, I love the monsters and how messy and just, yeah, that's what happened.
Yeah, I think they're hog roaches,
yes,
I believe.
Carpathian hog roaches. and then they even get in almost like a Marvin Pulp Fiction joke, because the middleman is going to take the afternoon off and leave Wendy to clean up the car. And I love his, like, well, look, if you're going to shoot a pig insect, could you just wait till it leaves the car? and the inside of the car is truly just covered in green gunk.
Well, maybe you don't know what happened, but maybe that hog roach just didn't even have an opinion of what the heck would happen, you know? It was played by Phil Lamar. You don't know.
Oh, God. I laughed out loud in the theater when Marvin got shot just out of shock. And it's one of maybe three times in my life that I've had a theater turn around and look at me because of laughing inappropriately at a moment. Very Bad Things. I also laughed during that. And the movie Three Extremes, I laughed. And there's a weird, if you've never seen Three Extremes, go check it out. It's a Japanese horror movie. It was grossly inappropriate, and the whole theater rightly turned around and stared at me. But the same thing happened when Marvin died, and I couldn't help but giggle when I saw the inside of the car. Of like, oh God, they just had that scene happened earlier. I just loved in my head imagining that, like, there are the rest of these scenes that you don't see of Wendy and the middleman at the cleanup points of all of these adventures.
Yeah, and you know what really amuses me about that whole sequence is the fact that how bad of a liar Wendy is. Just like, it's episode 7. Like, this is not new for her, and yet she can't. What's the excuse she comes up with? I stepped on a bug.
At a private zoo.
What zoo? Like, or she says, like, at a zoo. Like, what zoo's open at, like, on this day? Like, oh, it was a private zoo. Like, give her credit. She commits to the lie, as no matter how ridiculous it gets.
She's got a two-way risk communicator from her temp job. It's amazing. And I love that Lacey calls all this out, like, you're temp job.
Yeah, it's your
okay. Like, it's clearly that friend that knows you're lying and is just like, you know what, whatever, you've got your reason, but you know I know you're lying, right?
I mean, it's cool and everything, but like, just know that I'm not stupid.
Yeah. While Wendy's cleaning up the car, middleman heads out to see Ride Lonesome, which is the epic western that he's obsessed with. Randolph Scott, I love that it's on the poster, but the woman's name that's the female lead in this is Karen Steele. Which I loved, just the combination of like care and steel. Like, of course, that's the woman that that he's obsessed with. And Lacey, secret super spy, follows him to the movie theater. But of course, middleman catches on that he's being trailed and confronts her. They end up sitting together. I think at this point, she's already been referring to him as Pillow Lips and Sexy Boss Man for several episodes.
Oh, yeah. She's got it bad for him ever since they first meet eyes on each other. And who could blame her? Because middleman, I mean, again, I don't want to repeat what's been stated before in previous episodes. But if this guy was not in the running to play Captain America, someone in casting is not doing their job, because he's got that home down, like, handsome but nice look. And it's just like, how could you not fall for a guy like that? I mean, look at him.
Yeah, Matt Kiesler is the actor that plays middleman. When they started middleman in production at ABC Family, he was that guy's middleman. Like, that was Javier's casting pick. Natalie Morales looks substantially different than the Wendy Watson in the comics, partly because ABC Family did have some casting pull on the show in general. So the TV show's kind of a compromise from the comics, one that Grio Markswatch was happy with, but still, it's different from the comics. They actually make a huge point of this in the 2014 table read. But Kiesler has not done a ton of movies. I mean, he's done some recent stuff. He was in Dollhouse.
I'm looking here right now, and it's like, apparently he was in Mr. Magoo.
Yes.
In Scream 3. Whoa, okay. So I have seen this guy before. I just don't remember him.
And middleman is, a lot of these episodes are often full of that person that you don't know why you know them. You know them because they're in two episodes of everything you've ever seen. So middleman's trying to watch Ride Lonesome. Lacey's sitting next to him. And of course the middle watch goes off. And and I think he admits then he's seen this first act of this movie 16 times.
Six, 16.
Yes. But he's never seen the ending.
No. And wait, I gotta walk back just a little bit because there's another part that I find really hilarious. Is, well, one, Lacey follows him in this like trench coat getup that they never address it, and I love that. It's just that, like, why were you wearing this big trench coat? Like, oh, this is just what I wear to the movies. It's
such a hat and sunglasses disguise of like, well, I'm following someone, so I got to look as conspicuously spy-like, a stalker as possible.
And there's this one line that said, like, because he gets some snacks and stuff, but it's like,
they didn't have any of the cruelty-free organic vegan candy you wanted. They don't stock milk either.
And I was like, wait, cruelty-free candy?
And he's got it next time.
Yeah,
the next time they show up, he's got it at the ready. Cruelty-free vegan candy. Like, boom. And I love that he has a flask of milk.
Oh, is that what? Because
they don't sell milk. And he pulls the metal flask out and it's milk.
Oh, that's so appropriate.
That's some darn fine cow squirt. Yeah, his obsession with milk just cracks me up. I think in this episode, Dubby shows up with coffees and hands him, like, here you go. Coffee and milk hold the coffee for you. Coffee and milk hold the milk for me. Side note, I want someone in Hollywood to teach a class on holding empty cups upright. It is second only to actors looking at each other while driving.
Yes.
In terms of things that pull me out of a movie and make me freak out. Like, I assume everybody who looks at each other in a car and gives a monologue is about to die. Like, it just, I can feel the jump scare coming. And so when it doesn't, I'm always like, oh, you bastard. And I feel the same way every time I watch actors in a scene hold a coffee cup at like a 45-degree angle and then remember to drink out of it and hold it upright suddenly. I'm like, can someone just give them water in a cup?
I don't understand why they don't do that. Like, why is it a cup?
Maybe they do.
Cup?
Maybe I'm not noticing that I hold my cup at 45-degree angles all the time, but I don't think so.
No one does that. That's crazy. Like, I've noticed that as well, but I guess I've just gotten used to it. And as far as the milk goes, like, the one thing I think of, like, man, that's a hilarious running joke. And then secondly, it just makes me sad because I know Johnny Neal, this is just not a show for him. This is just drive him nuts.
Oh, I didn't even consider it. But oh, yeah, this has to be way up on the list of
he'd
milk
drive
and
himself
TV shows.
Crazy. He'd just be in his own bunker with just like just fucking strings attached to a wall. Just like, middleman, this is where it all comes from.
Now, I assume most of the audience is going to cross over, but we're talking about a TV dudes and otherwise running joke with, is it Johnny Neal?
Yeah, with Johnny Neal, where he has a whole milk conspiracy where he thought, like, I'm sick of milk being in all the TV shows. And what the crazy thing about it is that it was a crazy rant, but he started to be kind of right. Like,
yeah,
to notice it.
I wanted to laugh it off the first time I heard it, and now I see it. Now I like it. It jumps out at me. I mean, Westworld didn't help, but
no.
But yeah, and the middleman, he only drinks milk. I think there's an earlier episode where he's having a tall glass of milk while beating this guy's head into the car.
Mm-hmm. That's a damn fine cow squirt, which is, I've referenced that because I like to reference movies and stuff that I watch in real life. And I've already done that with milk at a restaurant, and I got really strange looks. Apparently that is not a common turn of phrase.
No, everybody I've ever said that to is kind of gone. It's like worse than saying moist. Like, that's not, don't want to think of it like that.
Then you try and explain, like, well, it's from a show. You know what? Never mind.
Yeah. So while they're at the movie theater, middleman actually manages to explain his job pretty concisely.
We're international consultants that solve exotic problems for corporations, individuals, and even governments. Obviously, our clients often prefer anonymity.
That's so clear. Concise. I wonder why Wendy's never said that to me.
That is a very simple, vague answer that is really easy to stay consistent on. Because he even says, like, oh, our clients, of course, prefer anonymity, so I can't go into the specifics. It's a fucking great lie, which is weird because it's like, oh, why has Wendy just not said that?
I'm like, y'all are best friends. Maybe she's worried about your judgment. But I love that later on when Lacey stumbles into kind of more of like, no, but what do y'all really do? She says, wait, so y'all are consultants? And his only explanation is, I said the problems were exotic. Like, that's a great cover story when it, you know, when you don't even have to add any words to it later. He just says the other half of the same thing he said earlier. Like, no, I already told you.
Yeah, it's the best lies are the things that aren't technically lies, like they're half truths. So,
so as he's bugging out of the theater because the middle watch is going off, Lacey slips him her phone number. and then we move on. And we know that that's got to be a Chekhov's gun. That thing's got to go off later.
Oh, yeah.
And it does. The reason that the middle watch is going off is because Double A, I love the criminal names in this show. You got Double A and his partner, Johnny John.
So Double A, and he's named that because he deals in arts and antiquities, correct?
Yes.
Because at first I was convinced, I'm like, oh, he's a battery villain and he has electrical powers. Like, that's where this show has put me in my mind, where I'm like, oh, that's obviously a battery supervillain. Like, that was where my immediate thought went to. And I'm like, oh, yeah, like, why did I immediately think, oh, this show has got me on the wrong track. This is a Titanic episode. Never mind.
Yep. And he's drowned in his hotel bed, of course, at the Peck and Paw Motel, which is a Sam Peck and Paw reference. So he's drowned, and not just drowned, he's got, I think, like a crab in his mouth and seaweed. Like, the water in his lungs isn't from the motel. And also, he's in his bed. Total locked room mystery. Like, how did this guy drown? So when they go see his partner, I love this. This is another one of those actors that you don't know where you know him from. Lance Barber, the guy that plays Johnny John. He has been in a ton of stuff. He always seems to be that slime ball, but just does a great job at it so much. He was in Leatherheads. He's It's Always Sunny. He's Bill Ponderosa. He was on The Comeback, Masters of Sex. He's been on a Bob's Burgers episode. He's, like I said, this show is just full of those actors. And so this is the guy where he answers the door and says, no, but I have a hot girl in here.
Look, I've got a beautiful woman in here who is hot, willing, and able, who finds me devastating in my raw feral power. Did I mention she was hot?
Yes.
Do you have an idea how rare that is for me?
Yes, I do.
Like, she didn't need to add that on. That wasn't necessary. No,
and I love he looks at her like that was unnecessary.
Yeah, why?
And but then when middleman goes, fine, you have 5 minutes. And like Wendy looks at him like he's running out the window. Nope, that was honest desperation.
I love it because it's a little too close to home for middleman at that point. You can tell it's been a long time for him as well. And I love
and he
that
he just left that date. Yeah.
They lock eyes and they got this little kindred spirit thing going on. I'm like, okay, yeah, I got it. Like, he almost fist bumps him and goes.
And then the awkward standing there in the hallway with Wendy. I'm like, yeah.
Oh, yeah, this is. And just hear the.
Yeah, it goes from like bed creak noise. Like, I love that trope. Just the neighbor bed sex. And then to just screams because he's being attacked by a succubus.
Succubus!
And like I said, there's not a lot of continuing mythology, but they do bring back characters. Like, there is a universe behind these people. The Fat Boy Industries logo is on everything, all the way back to episode one. But Roxy Wasserman, who is the middleman's kind of other love interest, like, there's clearly chemistry between them, and they both know it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I love that it's unrequited, and like they kind of treat it with this, like, well, yeah, I mean, we've got chemistry, but no. There's no pretext of like an episode of will they, won't they, or any of that. Like, they won't. But it's there in every scene, and it really comes through without any force. And so Roxy runs the fashion warehouse with all the succubus.
Yeah, she's there for any succubus or incubi that want to kind of avert their traditional, like, soul-sucking ways and kind of, you know, lead a little more of a normal life in the human world. And what I love about this episode in particular is that once they figure out that she sent the succubus in order to get this tuba, middleman shows up at their place and just fucking decks her.
Yeah.
Like doesn't even hold back. Like, whoa.
No greeting, nothing, just fist. And I also loved him. Of course, she has all her succubus around them, and he pulls out one of the many ubiquitous little grenades that we've seen throughout the series. And I think all he says is, well, then.
We've had some laughs, Rox, but we had a deal and you broke it. And there's consequences. You're sending your demons out to kill, and my sacrifice and that of my sidekick will have been worth it to stop me.
Excuse me?
Wait, did you say our sacrifice? I love how committed the middleman is. Like, there's no vacillation on his plans. Every once in a while in a scene, he just, like, takes it to the end, like, right then. Like, oh, well, then I'll kill everyone in this room.
Middleman, there's no half measures with the middleman. He's watched that last season of Breaking Bad, was like, no, we go on at full tilt or not at all. And yes. I do love that where he pulls out that grenade where I'm like, oh shit, that could be anything.
I mean, it could be a truth bomb. It could be a stun grenade. It could be anything.
I like they don't ever answer it, too. Like, they never really, like, go back to, like, oh, I was just kidding. This is a truth bomb or something. Because, and I do love that. It's like, you either cooperate or I'll detonate this and kill everyone here, sacrificing me and my noble young ward here. And I just love when he's just like, excuse me? Wait.
And, of course, this is where we actually get the info dump about what they're chasing. Because Roxy says, one of my favorite dumb lines from any sci-fi thing, the tuba changes everything. Roxy and the middleman have a truce about the succubus, and I love that that's her whole explanation. She's like, well, yeah, we've had a truce and we had our fun, but...
The tuba? That changes everything.
Let me answer that back with one of my favorite lines, which is also from her in this episode, which is that she says the line without any irony whatsoever, completely straight-faced.
And whosoever hears the E-flat rumble of its serpentine valves will drown in the icy waters of the North Atlantic.
Whoever hears the E-flat rumble of its serpentine valves will drown in the icy waters of the North Atlantic. And I'm like, okay, give this actress like an Emmy or a fucking award for getting that out of her mouth without snickering one time.
There's a lot of dialogue on Middleman in episodes where it seems like a dare that you gave to an actor. Like, they were backstage going, I bet you can get him to say this. Like, no, nobody can say that.
Just completely straight-faced and like it's nothing. Like, it's like a line they've read every day. Like, they're reading Shakespeare. Like, it's fantastic. I love it.
And I love that everybody has to keep repeating the icy waters of the North Atlantic. Like, nobody can just say, like, oh, he drowned in the icy waters of the North Atlantic. Of all the... jillion things that I'm going to keep repeating over and over about Middleman. I love that it does these catchphrases. It's part of what nods to 50s serials for me and to Flash Gordon and to old like Buck Rogers. And like it's something that nods to these old tropes in a way that it brings up why I love them.
Well, it's so weird to me because how much the show can vacillate between Buffy, Whedonverse 90s type referencing pop culture to easily 50s dialogue and references. Like, we'd even mention, like, the theater they go to, it apparently has, like, only enough budget, like, apparently can get enough revenue from just middleman visiting there every week. And they have an attendee in the background that's just dressed like a fucking 50s bellhop for, like, no reason.
No, it's like a fully operating theater from Last Action Hero, but, like, in its heyday. And it's titled, it's the Neighborhood Revival Theater. Like, I live in Austin, Texas, where there actually are art house theaters that are functioning, and they still barely function here. Like, I sit through it, like, there's no way that there's one pristine, well-kept theater that's running Ride Lonesome for this guy to watch 15, 20 minutes of it and then leave.
I was expecting, like, he was funding the entire, like, we were going to find out at the end, like, he funds the entire theater with, like, mismanaged, like, middleman funds or something. I don't know.
I would totally believe that would come up in a later season or something, that, like, that theater is paid for by OS or O2SDK in order to give middlemen someplace to go vent steam. Like, they just figure out whatever the current middleman wants and just buy that. Like, the 60s middleman just had an old cat house, you know.
Yeah.
But this guy has, like, a... glass of, well, I guess in that case it probably would have milk at the concession.
Yeah, if he paid for it, they'd have milk at the concession. Yeah. Ah, damn it, we've shot a hole in our own theory.
Yeah, there goes my no prize. So once they know about the tuba and they know what they're chasing, they head back to HQ and we get to see Ida really step to the forefront for the first time this episode. I mean, she's been in scenes bagging on Wendy. I'm sure she calls her a hophead by now or makes some pot related joke about her.
Yeah, and let me just say how much I love Ida. Ida is so fun. Ida, I love Ida. And this what's great about Ida is that she doesn't know it, but she's obviously got rejected from the offices working in Archer and ended up here instead. Like, she was, the thing is that she's too competent to work at ISIS, so she ended up here because she has that same kind of punching down kind of like acerbic humor of like just tearing down her coworkers that I absolutely love.
Well, and I like her constant, like, she's so much more capable than either of them or than any human, that like there's really not a great reason why Ida's not doing everything.
Yeah, she's like the out of the whole operation there, she's obviously like the brains. Like, she's what's actually keeping it rolling.
Oh yeah. Yeah, and she clearly has a connection to O2SDK that middleman doesn't even have, because she knows some things that come up in later episodes. And so, yeah, there's so much more to this show. while it doesn't lean on its mythology in any in one episode, I love how much depth you can see in every episode.
Speaking of like just her reference, like I think I gotta hold up one second.
I've got a hit.
Yes.
Never mind.
I love that. Because, well, she basically, she beats Batman to the punch on this. She basically turns on the same thing that Christian Bale does in the second Nolan Batman.
I am integrating with the World Surveillance Network, scanning all internet databanks and search engines, all communication networks, military and civilian. If anyone on the planet so much as utters the word tuba into a phone, I'll know about it.
Isn't it basically like the giant phone system? She's listening to if anybody says tuba anywhere near a microphone, basically.
There's just no Morgan Freeman to kind of talk down to her about, you know, possible like invasion of privacy.
That's like, where's Lucien on this? Like, yeah, there's just no worry about it. It's just her pacing around. I've got a hit!
What you don't understand is this is too much power for one robot alien to have.
I love that the explanation for Ida of why she's in that form, I think he may say broken, but it's just more of a shrug off of like, oh, she could change forms, but she doesn't. I like that she's just stuck on school marm, but I'm not entirely sure if it's an error or if she just likes this.
Not to spoil a later episode, but in the finale, we get to see another version of her and she still acts the same and then kind of switches back later. So I like to feel that this is just reflecting who she is in her soul.
Yes, kind of like how Marvin is always sad.
Yes. Yeah, I like to believe that when you look down deep into Ida, you just come out with a school marm every time. Like you might change your appearance or whatever, but it's still always that your third grade teacher that disapproved of you.
Right after we get our Ida moment, they decide to take a break after a bunch of hits that aren't anything. Just
I've got a hit.
Yeah.
An elementary school kid in Hong Kong won a medal for playing the tuba.
So Middleman, we know, is going to go back to try to watch the movie again. But Wendy heads back to the apartment and we get our first Noser moment from this episode.
Yo, Wendy Watson.
Hey, Noser.
So how did your day begin?
With a friendly voice.
Really? So all I heard was the sound of salesmen.
Of salesmen?
Yeah, of salesmen.
Weird.
I love Noser.
I love him too. He's like, they never show him smoking pot, but like, you know, like there's no question.
He seems to be the stoner character. I mean, he's just hanging out in the hallway. I don't think we've never seen him play that guitar.
I know this for sure. Cause I've gone back like the Zapruder film to try and figure this out.
But you hear about how great his album is. Like,
no, it's like Chekhov's gun if it actually never went off. Like, he always has the guitar. He's quoting lines from songs. And, like, we see, what was it? The Trout Zombie episode, I think. What was the name of his art piece of, like, oh, I know that song, but he never actually plays it?
Stump the Band.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, he's, like, holding me hostage with that guitar. Because I'm just waiting for the point where he's going to play it. And he never does.
But it's so wonderful because it's not just like when they do Stump the Band, it's not like Noser just instantly goes, yeah, I know it. He stops for a moment and like you see him look at his hand and like run through chords a little bit. And then, yeah, I know it. I love just the endless song references. And it's such a great friendship designator or moment for me between any two characters just to have Wendy take a minute and figure out what he's talking about. Like, they're always on the same wavelength. And, like, that's all you know about their relationship is that they are on the same wavelength. And it's all you really need to know.
Yeah, it's like, from the first episode, I think it was the Shaft reference. And you kind of like, oh, I totally get this relationship from, like, two lines of dialogue.
Yes.
It's actually really efficient storytelling, which is another thing. I know we talk about how ridiculous this show is, but you got to give it up for how well it writes its characters to a point where they get so much across with so little.
Yes, I'm also really impressed with how I know that this came out of Javier Grillo Marx Watch's head. Almost, I mean, the comic is so pure, Javi, like just so nerdy. And to know that this is such a one person's voice, but each of these episodes really are written by different people. And even though there was a writer's room, there are singular people that are featured as the main writer on each of these episodes. But the show feels solid and of a piece. Like, I don't feel like this show spent the first season trying to figure out who it was. All the actors seem to know what show they're in from the start. I know Natalie Morales had said to me that she didn't feel like it really got going until, I believe, like the next episode, like the eighth episode. for me, it hit the ground running. Like, it really all felt like they clicked immediately.
I was in love with each character, I think, like, from their first line of dialogue. It's rare for me to like a show as instantly as I liked this one. So I thought, I agree with you with the hit the ground running aspect.
So once Wendy gets back to her apartment, she gets back there and Lacey's dressed up to leave.
Hey now, Wendy Watson, solver of exotic problems, isn't the only one with a life.
You can see it click for Wendy. Like, that's a very specific turn of phrase.
Yes.
And I love little stuff like that. Like, they keep leading with that because it happens again later. So that it's not just one reveal at the end. Like, Wendy is figuring out, like, do you have a crush on my boss? I mean, I know you mess with me about my boss, but do you really like him? It's nice seeing that build.
No, they definitely throw the hints in there. They do their due diligence so that, like, just the reveals don't come out of nowhere. I mean, they treat like the mystery of this episode really isn't a mystery. That's not the mystery element, but the relationship stuff they treat like a genuine reveal and kind of planting the seeds thing. So
yeah,
the writers
even though
of the show
we've been
know
seeing
what they're
it
doing.
The whole time.
Like,
yeah. So we find out that Lacey goes back to the theater and they try to hit, you know, neighborhood revival Twilight matinee, and Lacey and Middleman are gonna have the date again. Of course, the watch goes off again. This time, it's the Arturo family who own the Peg and Palm Hotel, where AA drowned in the icy waters of the North Atlantic. And I love that the way they found this is because the Hadar, Ida, actually gets a hit that is something. And it's a kid blogging excitedly about having gotten a tuba, which may be the most unrealistic thing on a show that has parallel universes.
No, that one I had to stop and go, like, I'm sorry, what?
And the kid is super excited about this friggin' tuba, man.
Unless that is followed by a bunch of people cyberbullying him, then I don't think I buy this.
Well, I will say that he asked to borrow a mouthpiece off another kid in band, and like even the other kid looks over at him like, no. They go to Edward J. Smith Public High School, where this kid is going to be playing in a recital, and of course we know it's going to drown the entire audience in the icy waters of the North Atlantic if he plays. As he's sitting there, all of a sudden, we see Mr. Rogers, Joey Kern, show up and run through, grab the tuba, run out into the parking lot, immediately get hit. Someone takes the tuba from him and he gets shot.
So, okay, I have a little story about this, this particular part of the episode, because I was watching this whole series, you know, marathon through.
Mm-hmm.
My roommate comes in at this point, at this exact moment during the tuba thing. He's like, yes, well, what's this show? I'm like, this is Middleman. And it sees the tuba being stolen, and he's like, did that guy just steal a tuba from a child? I'm like, yes, he did. And he's like, well, why did he do that? It drowns people. What? And then they yell after they yell at him, Mr. Rogers, and yell and draw like, wait, Mr. Rogers stole the tuba? I'm like, I'm like, yeah, his name is Mr. Rogers. And suddenly they run out in the parking lot and he gets shot, like, immediately. Like, we're talking seconds.
Yeah, he doesn't have that tuba, but for just a second.
And then my friend is like, whoa, what the? He just got shot over a tuba. And then he gets brought back to life. And my friend is like, I gotta watch the rest of this episode.
I gotta sit down. What is going on?
It's an immediate hook in. Like, if you want to convince someone to watch this show, it would be weird. But I would highly recommend you just show them this one scene. Just that scene. Apparently, it's effective.
That's great. And so they take Rogers back to Middleman headquarters, and they walk him back through time and reveal that he's really Cecil Rogers. He's been doing different names, been immortal.
Our first reference to Highlander with a tuba.
Yes.
Which makes me think that, you know, of a brass section of just like that whole concept that I kind of want to watch. But, you know, the trouble about a brass section, a Highlander brass section, is that there's just not much of a harmony when there can only be one.
It's like that old joke. How do you get two oboes in tune? There can be only one.
There can be only one. I loved it. Like, oh man, what happened to our what happened to that our E section? Oh, a quickening happened. It was the quickening. It's just it's a thing that happens.
And I love that they start to do the like, your immortality must have been horrible for you watching, like, all of that. And Kern has, like, Cecil Rogers has none of that.
I bet you hear the screams of the drowning dead every night, haunting your every moment.
Actually, it's been a pretty good time for me. It was rough at first, but then about 10 years later, 1922, 23, started going to the gym, doing a little yoga. I ride horses, cars, became a stuntman, and I was good at it, since I can't die and all. I bought stock, calculators, then computers, some oil. I started dating. That's been going very good. Very, very good. So around 1955, I stashed a tube in a bank vault for safekeeping, and the rest has been history.
This has got to be my favorite part of the episode, because this guy, he's like the, like, you know, where the Twilight vampires or something like that, they'll always bitch about their immortality. This guy fully embraces it and his evil. Like,
yeah.
this guy starts off with the greatest premise ever with, like, the Titanic. Like, you've seen the movie, right? Well, you've seen the string quartet. Well, it didn't used to be a string quartet. I was part of that band until, like, I want to get the fuck out of here. I love the idea that one of the band members, during that whole scene of just, like, it's been a pleasure serving with you for the rest of my life. Hey, where's Carlisle? Where did he go? Like, just one of them fucked off. Like, oh, screw this, guys.
Yeah, because Wendy's like, no, I saw that movie. It's a string quartet. Yeah, it was a string quartet after I ran. Yeah, he's just a chicken shit, and he totally embraces it.
And look, he took the spot of not only a child, but a child with polio and his blind mother. That is the lore for this character.
Yes, because he wraps his tuba in a blanket and tells someone that it's a child. Oh, yeah, he's just horrible and, like, unrepentant about it. Just gleefully horrible. He's like everything I loved about Spike early on in Buffy. Like, he's just, he loves being terrible. So, of course, they find out that someone else now has the tuba, the person that shot and stole it from him, billionaire oil man Arthur Mendelsohn. And Rogers is supposed to play Nearer My God to Thee for all these Titanic nerds on Mendelsohn's boat, which is 3 feet longer than the Queen Mary and 86 feet longer than the Titanic. And I think they say that fact like five times.
Well, even in the text write-up when they end up going
yes.
to the ship, which, of course, we haven't mentioned the text screens for this show, but they're also hilarious.
Yes, they're amazing.
Like, where it always lets you know that it's an illegal sublet that they're living in. And in this one, like, it's referenced right after. It's like 86 feet longer than the Titanic, like, every time. What I love about it is that he's directly tied to the tuba. Like, if he destroys the tuba, he also gets killed.
Yes.
Which is, like, this great homunculus thing. Or, like, Horcrux thing, actually. Like, if you want to go to the the Harry Potter metaphor. And I love that he says, like, yeah, you know, the spit valve got clogged one time and I got pneumonia. Like, that's how connected I am to it.
And I like his explanation. Like, they go to this fancy party wanting to steal the tuba back or at least keep anybody from playing it because it'll drown everyone on that boat, right? But I love that they don't expect to see Rogers there because his explanation actually makes a lot of sense. It's like, man, do you know what would happen if I fell off a boat?
Yeah, and then middleman is just like, well, I assume that you'd drown, come back to life, drown again, and then keep doing that for the rest of eternity. Oh.
Like, yeah, yeah. Like, man, I'm staying on land. No. And I thought about that for a minute of, like, that would be the one thing you would have to watch out for as an immortal. Like, I don't be in a locked room. You know, because you could get trapped someplace and just be there.
Yeah, you know that one scene from Highlander where he can just walk underwater? Bullshit. Total fantasy. Not representative of immortals at all.
Getting ready, Wendy and middleman are going to go to the fancy boat party. And, of course, Wendy goes home and gets a makeover from Lacey. And Lacey, in another great bit of foreshadowing, says that Dr. Barbara Thornfield, I love that Lacey always refers to her mother by her full name with titles.
My mother, Dr. Barbara Thornfield, MD, PhD.
Oh, yeah. Like, it takes her. She's gotten to the point where she's almost like Daenerys Targaryen with how many fucking titles she has.
Dr. Barbara Thornfield, MD, PhD. Like, boom, every character, every time, it's Dr. Barbara Thornfield, MD, PhD. And that she already knows Arthur Mendelsohn. So when Wendy and middleman are on the boat, they turn around and we get a great middleman expletive.
Oh.
Tropic of Cancer, Wendy language.
Tropic of Cancer. Yes, I actually have that written down here in my notes under Robin expletives.
Yes.
If anything reminds me of the old Batman and Robin show of this one, is this middleman's expletives here. That's like one of my favorite ones of like the whole show of just like it's not quite holy costume party Batman, but it's pretty close.
Yeah.
It's pretty close.
And I love that Noser's there with Lacey. Like they turn around and they see Lacey and Noser, and you knew Lacey was probably going to try to sneak on there. But Noser's entire explanation, and Noser is in a formal tux with tails. And Noser's whole explanation is, if there's free lobster, I'm in tails. Like, he just knows where free lobster things are. It's like having that college friend that knew where open bars were. I love the idea that, like, Noser just occasionally hears about really high-end soirees and can just wherever he is, wherever his illegal sublet apartment is in that building, he has a tux with tails in it that is at the ready and knows how to tie that bow tie. Like I love the weirdness of this character.
Oh, and if anyone has an idea for a restaurant, could I get a restaurant that actually serves food that looks like it does on TV?
Yes.
So that at one point I can get a lobster that actually looks like a full lobster that they just slap on a slab.
Yeah, the thing looked amazing.
Like, when have you ever had a lobster dinner that ever looked like that?
Oh, almost no food ever looks like the meal, like, to a ridiculous degree. Of course, they sit down to this just amazing-looking formal dinner that Noser doesn't get to eat. I think he says later, what I had of the lobster was delicious. Middleman and Wendy get caught almost immediately on the boat because they get ambushed when they're walking around. And I love that they're walking around just a maze of endless hallways on this giant boat. They get ambushed by Johnny John.
Mm-hmm.
The fights, I love all the Sensei Ping moves. Like, I'm always a sucker for just goofily named martial arts moves. But Middleman turns to Wendy and says, Sensei Ping, Twisted Stones, count of three? 1, 2, 3. And then he does a move that she does no part of.
Yeah, because, well, she's in her dress like, oh, I can't actually do any stunts in this dress.
So. And then she's like, wait, what's my role in Twisted Stones? Oh, the counting. Oh, yeah. All right. But it works. Like, he, I think he knocks one guy out, takes the gun, and, like, kicks both his shoes off his feet and knocks the other two guys out. Like, it's just perfect goofy action movie.
Yeah, I almost wanted him to do a, like, I was surprised no Die Hard reference came after that where he's just shoeless the rest of the event.
Well,
like, I was surprised.
Not to spoil it if for folks who haven't seen it, but there's an entire Die Hard episode.
It's after this one, I'm pretty, well, unless Amazon has it fucked up, but there's a whole Die Hard episode that's fucking awesome.
The Nakatomi Protocol. Right after this fight, Middleman finds the tuba. And I love that he no sooner grabs it than they get stun batoned and they come to being monologued by Mendelsohn. This is one of my favorite things in this. Mendelsohn's not the villain, really.
No.
He's a pawn. And so he kind of starts a monologue that then Rogers finishes because Rogers is the real villain. And Rogers gets to say,
our plan is sheer elegance in its simplicity, isn't it?
Which turns up on every one of these episodes, I think, and I love it.
It's actually, I think it's actually after episode 5 is when it starts, if I'm thinking right. And the the plans are all super complicated and
oh, they're ridiculous
and really convoluted. That's why joke is. I think if there's one thing that this show didn't do that I wanted them to do. And this one, we'll talk about this later in the Sorbo episode that I think would have been really appropriate, is that I wanted Wendy one time to grab the collar of a villain and go, your plan is so fucking convoluted and doesn't make any sense at all. Stop it. It is not simple and or elegant.
Yes.
I wanted her to just lose it on one of the villains at one point.
Yes, I completely agree. And so after explaining his elegant and not at all simple plan, Rogers leaves to go play the tuba and kill everyone. I do like his plan. He has, in one spot, gathered everyone who knows anything or cares anything about this tuba and can get rid of all of them in one move and then put the tuba back in a bank. And as long as he never mentions it to anyone, he'll be safe. Like, it's really not a bad villain plan.
Out of a lot of the other villain plans in the show, it strangely makes a lot of sense.
It makes more sense than most. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like up there. I think it's like top three of like most practical plans of Middleman. So
they all, the villains all leave to go enact the plan, and they leave Middleman and Wendy tied up. And of course, Middleman manages to text Lacey, which signals to, and I love this writing, it signals to Wendy, how do you have my roommate's phone number? Oh, I looked it up from your emergency contact. My mom is my emergency contact. How do you have my roommate's? Oh, well, I'm good with numbers. I know a lot of them.
I have a mind for numbers. It's just yes. Like he's trying to lie.
I was waiting for him to just start naming random numbers. Like, because he says, like, the way he says it is like, I know many numbers. Like, I was waiting for him to say like 7 and 11 and 12. I know 13.
8675309. You know, that's.
And she's not having, she's not falling for it. Like, and gets it out of him that he does like Lacey and Lacey likes him.
International consultants. I solve exotic problems. You told her all that?
I was trying to help to make things easier.
How? She's my roommate and my best friend and you're my boss. How does that make anything easier?
But of course, Lacey then bursts in and legit saves them. Though I love Lacey's plan is initially to find an axe, and she hasn't seen an axe. She just knows there has to be an axe nearby, like in the movies. And sure enough, Noser looks over,
and there's an axe.
And I love that Noser wants to use the axe.
Oh, he's all on board on this.
Like when Middleman's like, but I have a handcuff key, it's in my pocket. And Noser's like, could I just use the axe, though?
And I love that one before, too, is that, you know, Wendy is not having it with him dating her roommate. Like, oh, you're dating my roommate? Why don't you just date my mom while you're at it?
Is she nice?
Ah!
I'm just kidding. It was a joke. To relieve the tension.
You want
to
relieve the tension? Don't date my roommate.
Is she nice?
What? Sorry, it's a joke. And I love it because
He doesn't tell jokes.
No, he doesn't do that at all. So it really comes off as really funny.
Oh, wrong. Yeah. Yeah. It's just great. So once they're rescued and then everybody heads out, I love the timing of Rogers is about to play and Middleman's fist comes into the frame and pops him in the face.
Bam.
And then it's on. There's this great fist fight. Wendy grabs the tuba and runs outside. Middleman's yelling at her over the intercom, throw it over the side. Don't argue with me. And she's not arguing with him at all. She's about to throw it over the side. And he's still.
It's that classic trope of assuming a conversation, even though one person it's all a one-sided conversation. And she's kind of completing it for a little bit, but then at some point he's like, don't argue with me, goddammit. I'm not arguing. What are you doing?
I'm not. Before she can throw it over the side, Rogers rushes out and manages to, I think, grab a rope off the deck and throw her off her balance so that he gets the tuba and Wendy falls over. This episode does a lot of really fun kind of slapstick Marx Brothers, like who's got the hot potato kind of, it's a goofy heist almost.
Yeah, I can't remember if I actually heard if there was a xylophone in the soundtrack, or if I just heard that in my own head when I saw the rope twist thing. I'm just like, oh, there it is.
It ought to have it. And of course, she hangs onto the side of the ship. Middleman manages to rescue her. They get up over the side just in time for Rogers to be about to play again at the on the deck with everybody around him. Of course, he's going to drown all of those people in the icy waters of the North Atlantic. Wendy looks over and goes,
step aside, boss. I got this one.
Sweet Molly Brown!
And out of nowhere, this Deus Ex Machina of a harpoon gun mounted to the bow of this ship. I love that what is clearly like a private luxury liner has this massive harpoon gun, because this Mendelsohn is rich and crazy enough to have this on the deck of the ship. And Wendy pulls the trigger on it and puts a harpoon straight through the tuba and Rogers, who both fall overboard in a not great bit of CG, but who cares?
Yeah, apparently it hits him so hard he gets knocked into a green screen. And I have it was great because, of course, my roommate is watching at this point, and we get to the harpoon sequence, and he just literally goes out loud, what the fuck?
Middleman's expletive on it is, sweet Molly Brown! Which, the unsinkable Molly Brown reference is just perfect.
And I love it because we've seen them pulled up from the shot and then running in the previous shot, and in none of those shots were any harpoon guns on the deck visible at all.
No, haven't seen this yet. Nobody's mentioned this at a cocktail party. Nothing. Nothing.
Why is it even there? Does this billionaire hunt whales in his spare time? Oh, he hunts whales in his spare time.
That's exactly what I was thinking. It's I totally feel like Mendelsohn has just gotten bored and shot whales off the, or shot something off this.
Now I'm sad because I've known that harpoon gun is used for many more murder.
Oh, yeah. Well, maybe the police confiscated after this. So then basically the episode is done and they do the epilogue scene of a middleman telling Wendy, I understand, I can't be romantically involved with Lacey, that this is going to be a bad idea. And you can see that, the sadness of doing that grown-up thing. And I love that he goes and has a dance with Lacey, and they do this wonderful slow dance, and Britt Morgan kills it in this scene. For a silly show on ABC Family,
she's giving it 110% in that scene.
She gives that relationship so much more than I expected. And it helps the scene so much. She drops a couple of tears, and you can see her. You can see the very, very real moment where it goes from, no, I refuse to let this happen, to the resignation of, this sucks. You see that acceptance. And
well, it's interesting because it's from the Titanic references in the show, she is obviously, she loves the Titanic to the point where she almost sings the song earlier.
Yes, I love that song. Yeah.
And then Wendy's like, I fucking hate that song. Don't sing it. Which might as well be, they might as well have gone to the dialogue like, we don't have the rights to that song, so please don't sing it.
Yes, exactly.
We don't have enough money to get that song. But I love that scene because she is actually I'm more emotionally engaged in that scene than almost any romantic scene in the Titanic. Because I'm not constantly thinking that, God, you guys are dumb. Like, which is weird, because this show just had a guy get shot with a harpoon gun in between a tuba and destroying his soul. And I was like, no, I'm way more invested in this. I feel way more of an emotional weight to this.
Because you can see her do the, like, Wendy won't be mad about it. Like, you see her try to bargain with it. Like, all these kind of stages of almost grief acceptance.
Yeah.
Where she's like, he's like, oh, no, it would be wrong. Your best friend is my associate that works for me. It would be inappropriate. And I love Lacey's argument of no, Wendy won't be mad if she knows it matters to me. And that is such a true and wonderful best friend statement of like she's not arguing that this isn't a bad idea or that this might not end badly. She's arguing that like, no, Wendy loves me and will let me have this.
I love that she's doing everything she can. Like she's. Well, one, she, like, tells the end of the, what's the name of the Western?
Ride Lonesome.
And she's telling, like, him the ending. And I almost kind of wanted Middleman to go, whoa, spoilers. The spoilers are the devil's bedtime stories.
Yes.
Like, yes. It was weird for me that he didn't have a little moral speech about spoilers and how they're evil. But I guess that wouldn't have fit the scene. And, yeah, like, she has, like, just the telling the end of the movie where like the hero gets what he really wants in the end, kind of like trying to like maybe if I foreshadow hard enough we'll hook up in a later episode sort of thing. Like she's trying to her character's trying to rewrite the show right there. I love it's like we can do a movie, right? Like there's nothing wrong with a movie, and I'm like no, a movie that's like second base and middleman baseball. That's too intimate for middleman.
This episode, for all its goofiness, it closes on a long shot of Wendy alone, and you see the weight of her watching Middleman and Lacey realize that, or Middleman realize that he can't have this relationship, and you're watching her realize this is the job I'm training for.
That's like a big reason that this is actually like my second favorite episode of the show. Like it's only right behind Trout Zombies for me. And like the reason is just like there's like an actual emotional weight to what's going on. The writing is super clever. Like even with the joke, like is your mom nice joke? Like it's preluded by my mom was my emergency contact, letting you know that in her inner mind she was already thinking about her mom's. Like that's where her side of the joke came from. Like why don't you just date my mom? Like there's setup for even a small joke like that. There's setup for it so it doesn't feel out of place later. It's the writing on this show is so goddamn clever and smart. Like I just don't understand how it got lost in the shuffle. It's such a tragedy of that this more people don't know about this fucking show.
Yeah, I think of shows where it feels like you have funny people involved, and so you have funny people saying funny stuff on improv at the tops and bottoms of scenes. But sometimes on shows you can tell like that's a funny line, but it's out of context. Because you just thought it up on the spot, so there was no time to set it up. You didn't know you were going to say that in the previous scene, so you couldn't telegraph that at all. It's part of what favors me to like word perfect shows over improv shows often, is that there's something particularly sweet to me about a teed up and knocked down great joke, even when it's short and small. Like even when the throw is really short, like. Prefacing the mom into the conversation before doing a mom joke rather than just doing a mom joke.
Like it's that sense of structure that like leads you through, and like you never feel like you know where you are in the scene, in the episode, in the season, like where everyone is. I don't know. It makes me feel more comfortable like in a structured show of just like, oh, everyone knows where this is going, including the writers, the actors, the characters. Like everything is moving in a solid direction, and it feels like that the entire there's not a scene in this show that feels aimless, like it's not going anywhere. Like everything is very, very precise and very methodical, and everything is purposeful.
Yeah, once things start happening in the plot, they just continue to click off of a list. Like, you feel like you're on rails running towards the end of it, and I love it. You don't feel rushed through it, but it's purposeful. Anything written, I realize, is purposeful, but the show feels focused. For as scattered and constant as the references are, the reason that all of that can work is that you have such a sturdy framework of plot.
Every time I watch an episode of the show, I have to remind myself, like, oh god, that was actually like 45 minutes. Like every time I feel like, oh, it feels like I watched a 22-minute show, like that I would watch on ABC usually, and it's the time just flies by of just how the pacing of this show is just fucking amazing. Like it's great.
Yeah. When I was asking people about possibly co-hosting, somebody said to me, well, I'll have to watch them again and catch back up, but at least they're only half hour. At least they're not an hour long show.
Yeah.
And I messaged back. I'm like, man, it's an hour long show. I mean, it's only 42 minutes because of commercials not being there, or 48 minutes, whatever. But man, no, it's an hour long show. It just flies. There's no slow motion song in the middle of every episode.
I think that's what makes it the opposite of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. for me, because I feel Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.'s length whenever I watch Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Like, even the good episodes of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., I'm kind of like, this is going on pretty long. And in this one, it's just like, nope, we got to hit everything, and we're stretching out for this amount of time, and every scene lasts exactly this long, exactly the length it needs to. The edit, you know what? I always credit like the writers on the show, but the editor on the show is really good too. Like the whole production really is kind of just on fire, firing all cylinders.
And that's also that editing is so big on comedies for me. Editing is always the thing that makes the jokes pop. For me, like, too often I've seen shows or movies where I'll go, pretty sure the script is good. I'm pretty sure if I closed my eyes and had everybody say their lines a little faster, this would be funny. But we've all seen things that are just put together badly.
Yeah, it inspires me with, like, that the writers have confidence in themselves, because it's like, sometimes you feel like the writers are really like, well, this is a joke and I really like this joke. I want to make sure everyone hears the joke. I don't want them to be stepped on by laughter from a previous joke. But my favorite comedies are like Archer, even Parks and Rec kind of like does that, where it's just like everything is like fast, like everything is like we're on to the next joke before the previous joke is even finished. So if you missed it, you can catch it on a rewatch. We're not going to worry about it.
Yeah, in fact, it's one of the things that makes the show just infinitely rewatchable for me, and why, even having seen it several times to do these recaps, I paused it so often. Side note, it looks like the editor for this is James Renfro, which he also edited most of Superstore, which makes a lot of sense. I think Superstore is a pretty good comedy as well.
Yeah, I have not had a chance to watch Superstore yet, but I hear good things.
But yeah, it looks like everything this guy's done is pretty quick-paced comedy. I think he did great on this episode of Middleman. Well, I think that about wraps up everything we could talk about on this episode.
Yeah, considering I think we've talked longer than the actual episode length runs on.
Well, there were commercials. There were commercials.
Yeah.
Well, thanks again, Nick. This has been great. And we're going to have you back to co-host another episode, episode 9, I believe.
Oh, great. I get Sorbo as well. Awesome.
Yes. But y'all don't know about that yet. Watch a couple more episodes and we'll see you then. Good Die Young is an independently run podcast produced by Les Weiler and hosted as part of the Permanent Record Network. We can be found on the web at The Good Die Young TV.